Good evening. My name is Catherine McNamara, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, it is my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's event, What Voters Need to Know, Implications for Domestic Policy. To be an informed voter in the 1896 United States presidential election, one essentially needed to have a position on one single issue, maintaining the gold standard versus adopting free silver. William McKinley defeated William Jennings Bryan to become the 25th president of the United States, largely because of his support for gold as a metal to back up U.S. currency. In contrast, a multitude of domestic issues are of concern to voters in the 2008 presidential election. Presidential candidates are expected to hold detailed policy stances on topics as varied as the economy, healthcare, national security, gender and social issues, and the environment. Obviously, today's voters face an increasingly complex domestic policy agenda. Tonight's panel of Dickinson professors will examine U.S. domestic policy to help voters with a deeper understanding of the relevant issues. The panel includes Michael Hyman, Professor of Environmental Studies and Geography, Stephanie Gilmore, Assistant Professor of Women's Studies, David Sarcone, Assistant Professor of International Business and Management, and Daniel Kenny, Visiting Professor of Political Science. Stephanie Larson, Professor of Political Science, will moderate. At this time, I'd like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and pagers. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Please note that student representatives from the College Democrats and College Republicans will ask questions of the panelists prior to the general question and answer session. Because this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hard of hearing, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking a question. Following the program, all are invited to a reception. Refreshments are being provided by the Central Pennsylvania Alumni Club. Now, please join me in welcoming our panelists.
Thank you. I suspect that people are here for a variety of reasons. Some of you are required to be here for a class. Some of you are maybe curious what we mean by what voters need to know, and you think maybe we'll be giving out registration cards or something. No, it's going to be policy information. And then some of you might be here because you already know who you're going to vote for, and you want to advocate and fight with people who disagree with you and be charged by people who agree with you. Maybe not the right panel. I mean, we're trying to be very, not advocates. We're trying to really serve the late deciders and the independents, the voters, and the people who may be registered but still not even sure if they're going to vote because they're still unsettled a bit on that decision. And I know that this is a much maligned group, and if you're in it, you're probably not going to admit it to anybody because the press and the very partisan and the very involved people think there must be something wrong with you if you haven't decided yet. And I think what the problem is there is it doesn't really take into account the complexity that you might have made this. I mean, there's some people really don't feel like it's legitimate to vote party anymore, or that it's legitimate to vote in terms of character, confidence with the person. They might think it's not even legitimate to vote for a single issue or a couple of issues, that maybe they have to know everything in order to really responsibly vote. And that's not the threshold that the Founding Fathers had in mind, and it's not a threshold that's reasonable for you to sort of cast, you know, sort of, keep yourself up to that standard when not everybody else is. Part of it is we want to think that you're like a driver of a car. You don't have to be the mechanic, okay? The government's supposed to be there to do that. You know, they're more of the experts than you, but you need enough information to be confident about your vote. And that's a lot easier said than done. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not paying attention, but what you're paying attention to might not be very useful. You're watching the news, and they're telling you who's ahead and who's behind, and they're telling you what ads are being run and why, and they're like second-guessing the candidate's strategies, and they're telling you where they are, and they're covering Joe the Plumber, and you're not really sure if you're a Joe the Plumber or not, or who is that guy. And so you're watching a lot of news, and you're no closer to making a policy decision that meets your own standards. Well, part of that is a problem with the media, not a problem with you. And I don't think we have the media that we deserve. I think we have the media that's evolved, okay? And it's strategy-based, horse race-focused, and very superficial. If you turn to the cable news networks and you go Fox or CNN or MSNBC, you get a lot more of the inside the beltway chatter. They give you a lot more time and they talk a lot more, but they reference things that you might not even know exactly what they're talking about. I remember my mother 4 years ago said, I don't understand how they decide if you're a red or a blue state. They keep talking about red and blue states. Now, by now, everybody knows that, but it's like kind of 2000, you know, the commentators just assumed you knew that this was sort of a Republican leaning versus Democratic leaning. They're not going to explain a lot. They assume you're already there with them. So they use handles and references to things. They talk about stuff that if you didn't get in on in the beginning, you get lost. You feel a little disengaged, that it's kind of going, the train is leaving without you. And you're not sure how to catch up so that you can be a part of something you want to be a part of, which is voting in a democracy. And so one solution you could say is turn to experts who are going to try to help you out in a non-advocating sort of way, but more of a, look, I have some more expertise and I can boil it down for you. And that's what our panelists are going to try to do. I'm not going to do that, in part because I'm not on the panel, I'm a moderator, and in part because my expertise is the media, who I just sort of criticized, rather than a policy. But I do believe that, you know, we can tell you about an issue and you might or might not be interested in that issue. You know, we would be here all night if we included every issue. So what we really have to do is not give you the fish, but teach you how to fish. And that is something that I hope to be a little bit helpful with. If you want to get news about policy, don't turn to television news, even though it might be more entertaining and easily accessible. You have to get it somewhere else. On the other hand, do you get it online? A lot of people think that's going to be a solution because there's so much policy information online. There's so much information. But there's so much information you might drown in that tide. And when we turn to the internet, we're not really sure where some of that information came from and whether people are trying to con us or they're actually giving us something useful. And so, you know, you have to become sort of a librarian, researcher, expert or something to sometimes work that. And so, again, you kind of feel ill-prepared. You know it's out there, but you don't know where to turn exactly. And so what I've provided is just a little Professor Larson's four websites you might be interested in looking at to sort of learn how to fish a little bit. And I've made this in a handout. If you're interested, take one, move it along. There's 30, which would almost cover us. And basically the first two are on issue positions where you can really pick the issue position that you're interested in and find out more about it. Now, some of this, people get a little scared. Interest groups, I don't want to hear what they have to say, but realize interest groups do a lot of research for us. You know, so the NRA has really been monitoring gun policy. You know, they've been looking at every congressional vote or amendment or everything on that because that's what they're interested in. So it doesn't mean that you have to take what they say when they endorse somebody. You though know where they're coming from. And so if you find out that a candidate supported the NRA's position in like 70% of the cases that they got to vote, the issues they got to vote on in Congress, well then, that's going to be useful. And some of these websites help you get that information. What you make of it is up to you. And then the last two have to do with checking out on is this fact or is this fiction? There's a lot that we hear in ads that sound very easy to understand and compelling, but we don't know whether we're going to believe it or not because we know it's got a self-interest behind it. And so do you use that? Don't you use that? Well, these two websites really are doing the research that you don't have time to do to kind of say, okay, this is where that claim came from. This is the evidence for it. This is the limitation of that evidence. Do with it what you will. And so these four websites, rather than doing these broad searches and you put in gun policy and whoa, what comes up, really help focus your energy because being a voter shouldn't be a full-time job, but it should be a satisfying one. Sorry. Now, how we're going to do this is we're just going to allow each panelist to talk. We're going to have students asking some questions, and we're going to have you ask some questions. And we're going to start with healthcare. Okay. So, Professor Sorkin.
Thank you. The issues associated with healthcare are well chronicled around cost, quality, and access to care, as is evidenced by this cartoon. What I hope to do in the next few minutes is really talk a little bit or is present to the audience a framework to use in analyzing the presidential proposals on healthcare. And again, I put too much on this, but the three things that really kind of stand out with the belief system. Oh, sorry. The beliefs that serve as the foundation for a framework for reform review, and then comparing and contrasting the two plans within that framework. The framework was developed by the Ethics Force program, a collaborative initiative by the Institute for Ethics that's associated with the American Medical Association. So I was using that, borrowing that, but it seemed to be a pretty strong or a solid framework to go with. I'm going to, given the time, I'm going to flip through some of these and talk a little bit about a health system. Health systems really talk in terms of, you know, both the financing, provision of services, delivery, research associated with providing care to patients. The purpose of a healthcare system broadly is to enable citizens access to healthcare and to provide that in a cost-effective way, and in that process also meeting an established standard of quality. Now quickly, that's kind of a broad definition of objectives for a health system, and essentially the objectives which both candidates support. In the United States, and the underlying beliefs to support this framework talk in terms of the following three: equality of opportunity, which you can clearly read, justice. I think justice is an interesting one. One of the issues has been, you know, the cost of health care, not only is it the cost of the individual, but the cost of society, and the fact that as that grows, and I can throw out all the numbers, you know, we talk in terms of health care now being 16% of GDP, targeted toward 20%, that essentially is saying that within the next 5 years, one out of every $5 or one out of every $5 resource, 20% of the resources of this country will be devoted to health care. At what point does that, you know, really start to push out other significant social issues? So that's when we talk about justice, and of course, compassion for the least fortunate, in the sense that it's been clearly demonstrated those that do not have access to care have, suffer more as a result of not being able to get adequate health care. The framework, quickly, is comprised of four guidelines. And I'll briefly explain this. The first one's pretty straightforward. Every member of society must have an adequate array of core health care benefits. So everyone should have access to health care benefits at an established level. The second part is, what is that level? And the authors of this guideline talk in terms of those benefits being established in an ethical and transparent way. So there's some discussion about what really forms a core basic care that can be provided. Finally, the health system must be sustainable. That gets back to the issue of justice and also efficiency, that you must be able to do this in a cost-effective way, in a way that makes sense to society. Again, on that particular issue, and there's a tremendous amount of literature on what is the right cost and when is the cost too much, often revealed by society. But I think this discussion, it says we're at 16%, we're headed to 20%, people are starting to get concerned. So, you know, we're probably getting to that point where, reining in those costs moves from something that we might do to something that we must do. And then finally, the health system must ensure that stakeholders have clear responsibilities for which they are accountable. And this gets back to issues like, what's the responsibility of society? What's responsibility of the individual for financing care? You know, how do we work within that system in an efficient manner? How do we provide services that have a high level of quality? How do we monitor those activities? So all those kind of governance and management issues to ensure that the system works efficiently and effectively. If we quickly move to the first of the guidelines, which talks in terms of every citizen having a core health benefits, there's been really two approaches from the Democrats and the Republicans on this. And when I talk about this, let me just preface this by saying neither of the plans require mandatory coverage, some exception with Obama with regard to children. Both support kind of private-public partnerships, and on top of that, neither of them, interestingly, get at really some of the cost drivers in healthcare with regard to technology and the translation of that technology into services and the payment for those services. So there's, in both cases, there's some strengths, in both cases, there's some weaknesses, but I just kind of wanted to list these or break this based on this framework. Quickly, if you look at the Democratic approach, they talk in terms of a mandate for children, that is, that parents would be required to have health insurance for their children. They would do that, the way that they would create that capacity or ability to do it for those who may be challenged in paying for it is the expansion of Medicaid and the CHIPS program. The Democrats talk in terms of the development or the introduction of a new health insurance plan, referred to as a national health plan. They talk in terms of a national health exchange, essentially kind of electronic form for people to purchase insurance. They talk in terms of, and this is where it kind of gets interesting, that there would be guaranteed eligibility for insurance. That is, there were preconditions. There would be no exclusion as a result of preconditions. Everybody would be able to get insurance. There would be community rating, that is, the underwriting that goes on right now where people are paying more or less based on their health status would go to a flat rates or relatively flat rates. To help support families and small business, they talk about tax credits. Player pay, for those of you who may not be familiar with that terminology, is to say that in the Obama model or in the Democratic model, they still strongly believe in employer-based health insurance. Player pay says for those firms that aren't providing health insurance, they will be mandated to provide health insurance, or they will have to pay a payroll tax above that and kick into the funds that would help support insurance for their employees. And reinsurance subsidy really says, look, if we are going to require that insurance companies do community rating, that all people are eligible regardless of preconditions, some insurance plans, a lot of insurance plans are going to get hit with people who have catastrophic illnesses, and these could really impact health insurance companies as far as their profitability, given that in the event that there are catastrophic cases, there would be some subsidy or some kind of reinsurance. Each one of these items you could spend a day on, so I'm just kind of getting through these quickly. On the other side, with regard to the Republicans, the McCain approach really talks in terms of a tax-exempt status elimination on health care benefits. So health care benefits, which have been shielded from a tax standpoint, would now become taxable income to individuals. So if you're a family and you're receiving family coverage, and that comes to $12,000 or $13,000 a year, that $12,000 or $13,000 now becomes part of your income, and it's taxable, all right? To offset that, the Republicans suggest a taxable refund, cash in the pocket, of $2,500 and $5,000 to individuals dedicated to paying or focused on paying for health insurance coverage. Now, the mechanisms of this really not all that complex. That is, the higher income, the larger the tax rate, the smaller the real benefit, you know, in contrast. So you really, the net effect of the tax plus the refund is going to be kind of sliding based on where your income is. And so we can talk about that maybe in the questions. Finally, expansion of health savings accounts. One thing that's interesting in the Republican plan is they also realize that there's going to be individuals that may not be able to get health insurance because of their health condition, because of their health. So the Republicans suggest the creation of guaranteed access plans, which really are kind of pools for high-risk individuals. There are some of those in place right now. That's very quick, and actually the core of this. Most of these plans will have a tendency to look at, from the political standpoint, creating access. Okay, they'll look at cost and quality, but really this issue of access and equity tends to be the big driver. We're going to quickly move through the others. This is interesting. In the guidelines that were presented in that framework, the second one says, look, there should be some minimum standard of a package of benefits for individuals. All right, there should be some way of establishing essentially a baseline. From the standpoint of Republicans, not stated. In the case of the Democrats, they talk in terms of establishing a base array of benefits which equate to the current federal employee health benefits plan. So they're starting to look at, you know, kind of matching up with what federal employees can get. And for those private health insurance firms, particularly the ones that will participate in this national health exchange, that they, to participate in the exchange, must also meet that requirement. In other words, they need to match the NHP benefits. So at least in the case of the Democrats, there's this discussion about creating a base as far as as far as array of benefits. And there's some argument with that, which we can get into, whether that makes sense or not. Finally, sustainability. This, and I'm going to move quickly through this just with the minute or two I have left. After this, you could close your eyes. You know, you could put your hand up over the Democrats, the Republicans, with regard to cost management, with regard to accountability issues. Both in the area of cost, talk in terms of electronic health information, fraud and abuse, medical liability reform. Interestingly, in reading the plans, the original plans on the Democratic side, much stronger language, much more assertive or aggressive language with regulatory power, particularly over pharmaceuticals and the insurance industry. Really, the discussion or the language seen in the Democratic proposal is really absent in the Republican proposals. And so from the Republican standpoint, they'll talk in terms of trying to manage pharmaceutical pricing by allowing reimportation of pharmaceuticals if they can be purchased at a lesser cost, as do the Democrats. But the Democrats talk in terms of things like, you know, limiting profitability on insurance firms and regulating rates. It's kind of slippery language. I mean, you kind of have to watch it, but there's a clear difference there as far as regulatory initiative. Finally, in this area of responsibility and accountability, that is talking in terms of efficiency, quality of service, participation of patient and physician in their own care, you see the same type of things. You'll see this real push toward disease prevention, health promotion, disease management programs, coordinated care. This language has been around for, let me think, 25 years. All right, you know, if they make it happen, God bless them. But, you know, they believe that these are the ways to go, and intuitively they are. Pay for performance, which really talks in terms of a change in incentivizing providers as far as how they'll be paid for care. And then finally, you know, being very transparent and very public with regard to quality and cost reporting. So in summary, very quickly, if you look at those four guidelines, one is, you know, every citizen should be guaranteed some basic core of benefits. Number two, that core of benefits should be, you know, negotiated and discussed in a transparent and collaborative way. Number three, the system should be sustainable. And number four, there should be accountability and responsibility across all stakeholders and try to divide out, you know, the provisions of both programs. That way it might serve as a reasonable way of making a decision. Okay, let me get this up.
Okay, next, all right. Next, we're going to hear from Professor Kenny. He's going to be talking about economics. So let's see how that goes in 7 minutes. But economic policy.
Was that close?
Right. Thank you, Professor Larson. Right. So 7 minutes to talk about the economy. And after that, I will defuse a nuclear device in front of you, which would probably be slightly easier. I, for the most part, am not an economist. And the perspective of this panel, I think, brings together those individuals who have both a sort of wide-ranging expertise. My expertise is in sort of quite generally American politics and the presidency. But I feel sort of that I can speak to the question of economics, mostly through an understanding of American institutions. So I want to talk kind of generally first about what is likely to be the initial outcome, right? We're most likely going to deal with a Democratic Congress. There is a very remote chance that the Republicans will seize control of either the House or the Senate. And so given that, we have to think about the world in, if McCain wins, as operating under a system of divided government, right? Or under a system if Obama wins, operating under a system of unified party government. And so I think the implications of that sort of quite obvious point should be something that we consider, and maybe that will help you make your decision going forward. I want to organize this talk in sort of a broad, again, broad nature, and I only have probably 5 minutes, but to focus on the fact that either an Obama or a McCain administration is likely to face a series of tremendously challenging facts about the economy, we're likely to see a rising elderly population that's going to need an increasing amount of medical attention. We're likely to see an increasing rise in income inequality. We're likely to see an increasing contraction of the aggregate macroeconomy. And so the basic facts, right, are going to be that the economic situation for either president is going to be arduous. How are each of these candidates going to deal with it is kind of a challenging question. We don't see much of a distinction between the two candidates in a number of different areas. I want to focus this talk primarily on their approach to foreign policy, primarily dealing with foreign economic policy, and then talking quite briefly about the differences in their tax plans. Again, taxes tend to be a bit of a snooze for most people, but I think that it tends to cut to the quick of what actually American politics is about. So starting with Obama then, Obama has promoted the idea of re-evaluating NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Act, and focusing primarily on questions of labor regulation and environmental regulation. And this is a sort of clear attempt to get us to the question of how we're going to address problems of structural unemployment that are the result of jobs moving overseas, primarily to China. And approaching NAFTA from and renegotiating, attempting to renegotiate NAFTA from the perspective of labor rights and environmental concerns is not something that McCain has come out in support of. For the most part, the clear division, the ideas division between the two candidates centers on this question of markets, and that the Republicans have promoted the notion that injecting into the economy a limited amount of taxation is likely to be the best course of action for promoting macroeconomic growth. The Democrats and Obama supports this idea, do not in fact see this, to use the term sort of loosely, supply-side approach to economic policy as being the way to stimulate the economy. Moving on to the sort of second big question, of course, is where is a lot of our debt going? Well, of course, it's going primarily to China, which holds roughly 25% of our current account deficit. And a Obama administration is likely to maintain a sort of status quo with China in order to support that level of debt. And there has been some discussion, and it's at this point unclear as to whether or not there would be an attempt to renegotiate that debt in any sort of meaningful way. It's unclear. And McCain is not, as far as I understand it, maybe the audience can correct me, hasn't talked that much about China as a foreign policy trader either. Move on sort of very briefly into a discussion of taxes. And the perhaps singular achievement of the Bush administration, the thing that they, if we can look back on that, the thing that they're perhaps going to be the most proud of, if you were to ask George Bush, is the successful Bush tax cuts of 2001 and 2003, and perhaps even embedded within that is the estate tax, which of course is going to kick back in 2009 if the sunset provisions are not reinstated. And it looks like both Obama and McCain are interested in avoiding a reinstatement of the pre-2003 estate tax. The estate tax is an interesting question, and oftentimes it's not simply those individuals who are wealthy, but it sends a signal, I think, to everyone as a democracy where our sort of priorities lie, in that are we going to continue to tax those sort of wealthy incomes? And for the most part, moving into 2003, the estate tax had focused on incomes only above $560,000. So if your inherited wealth exceeded that, then there was some level of about 40%. There was a tax below that. You were, of course, exempt. McCain and Obama are both, it has become a consensus, and this is sort of fascinating, they have both argued for a return to a much higher level of exemption for the estate tax. For Obama, he promotes the idea of a roughly $3.5 million exemption, or $7 million for those couples. And above that, we're looking at a 45% tax rate. Now, this seems quite boring, but it's significant because McCain's proposal is not radically different. We're only looking at a roughly 5 million individual versus $10 million exemption, right? So the difference is marginal at the estate tax level. And the estate tax is, again, an important signal as far as the level of sort of the progressive nature of the tax code, because of course it the goal of the estate tax is to focus on inherited wealth, and there is a kind of an American ideology that seeks to avoid aristocratic fortunes and the development of hierarchy. And so the estate tax was an unobjectionable device up until roughly 2000, beginning of the 2000s. These primary distinctions, and we can go into, and maybe in the Q&A, have a longer discussion about Obama and McCain's approach to, for instance, capital gains, or their larger kind of tax plans. But at the margins, there is what's surprising is the consensus that both parties have arrived at in terms of wanting to limit the amount of taxation for the American public, which historically has been, we've accepted a much higher level of tax. So where are we about? Another 2 minutes. Okay, wow. All right. Well, I can wrap, and then we can pass that time over to the Q&A. And I think the Q&A is important. Oftentimes these panels tend to run kind of long, and we don't get a chance to talk. So we'll do that. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. Next, we're going to be hearing about environmental policy, or a sliver of that, from Professor Hyman.
Okay, I was hoping I wasn't going to face an audience of undecided voters. If you're still undecided, well, I hope I'm not here to influence your vote either way. I'm not advocating for any one candidate tonight. I'm no great proponent of the two-party system. I want to point out that both Ralph Nader, as running as an independent, and Cynthia McCain, running with the Green Party, have what I consider to be, at least on the environment, much more progressive positions than either candidate. But I'll stick to the two candidates that are most likely to one or the other take the position. The most important problem that we face environmentally, and both of our top candidates agree, would be global climate change. But that's linked to energy. Energy is the largest source of environmental contamination, if you will, both through its procurement as well as through its use. Both of the candidates, McCain and Obama, would embark on a radical departure from the existing administration with regard to recognizing global climate change as a pressing issue and involving us most likely in some kind of international agreement to limit the emission of greenhouse gases. There's three issues that come to mind when we talk about energy. One is the environmental consequences of energy procurement and use. There's also the national security when it comes to our energy. 60% of our energy, oil I should say, comes from foreign sources, and of that, total of 15% is from the Middle East of our total oil consumption. And third would be the price, which McCain certainly has focused on recently, as has Senator Clinton through their proposal for a national gas tax holiday this summer. But turning to climate change, both of the candidates suggest that they will impose some kind of a cap and trade agreement where we cap the total amount of carbon dioxide emissions and then trade the emissions. If you're an emitter and you reduce the amount that you emit greater than that which you're allowed to have, McCain would actually allocate for free to existing polluters, if you will, emitters, initially allocate the permits to release the carbon dioxide, while Obama is in favor of an auction. The allocation is one that was tried in by the European Union with not much success. What happened was that they allocated more permits than the companies needed, and there was a windfall profit, in fact, for the companies that were emitting and then cut back, which they were going to cut back anyway. Obama would actually auction the permits, and then some of the money that's generated from the auction, the sale of the auction, would, about $15 billion would go to renewable energy advancement through wind and solar power tax credits and so on. But the majority would be returned back to the consumers. Most of it would be returned back to the consumers in some form or another. Obama is in favor of generating about 4 million green jobs through this process. Support for SECI claims. I want to point out, though, we just heard about NAFTA. Because of our world trade agreements, there's no guarantee that the millions of jobs that Obama has been proposing in connected to support for green energy and so forth would necessarily go to U.S. companies. I think it just as easily the solar panels could be made in Japan or in China, although the installation most likely would be Dickinson students when they graduate. Okay. Now let's go to something else. When it comes to renewable energy, biofuels is a big issue. McCain, by and large, is a believer in the supply side approach to renewable energy and so forth, and is not a big supporter of tax credits and so on. But they both do support biofuels. In Obama's case, with much greater financial support than with McCain. I want to point out, though, that one kind of biofuel in particular was quite worrisome, and that's corn-based ethanol. And you have to realize that Obama's coming from a corn state. And where's the first primary? It's in Iowa. So nobody wants to dish corn-based ethanol. But corn-based ethanol has serious problems. We're not even clear that it is a net helps us much in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. It takes fossil fuel to grow that corn. And there's tremendous problems with regard to pesticide and fertilizer runoff. Obama is in favor of about 60 billion gallons by 2030 in our supply. And this is also a target that was proposed by the Bush administration, part of our 2005 Energy Act. It's doubtful we'll get there. Much more promising, and both candidates support, is cellulosic ethanol from agricultural waste products, where the net gain may be 80% or more in terms of a net energy, a net greenhouse gas emission reduction. In terms of energy supply and security, you've heard about the debate over offshore oil drilling. I want to point out that McCain's basically a federalist and believes in leaving the decision to the states. That would be lifting the congressional ban on offshore drilling. That might not have as much effect as you would believe listening to Palin and to McCain, because the majority of governors, the majority of states at the present time would not allow offshore drilling. Most of the offshore drilling in this country is occurring where it is supported by the states. Those are our Gulf states, Louisiana, Texas. It may be an issue in Florida. The states along the West Coast, California, Oregon, and Washington are not in favor of offshore drilling. Alaska possibly. On the East Coast, almost every governor except Georgia and I think Delaware are opposed to offshore drilling, and there is very little offshore oil in those states. So we're not sure that's going to have much impact, lifting the congressional ban or not. Obama is, of late, in favor of lifting the ban only if it can be a commensurate support for renewable energy. As far as nuclear power, McCain is a major supporter of nuclear power, 45 more nuclear power plants by 2030. I want to point out that a new nuclear power plant today, a 1,000-megawatt power plant, easily could approach $9 to $10 billion. That's even more expensive than if we were to rely on wind or solar. The same amount of investment in wind or solar could be had for same amount of energy could come out of wind or solar for probably less investment. The issue there is that wind and solar is intermittent. We need a backup. So the backup most likely would be when the wind doesn't blow, when the sun doesn't shine, might be natural gas. We can flip it on pretty quickly. For Obama and McCain, they both believe in something called clean coal. Have you heard that term before? There is no such thing as clean coal. It's a joke. It's a lie, because they're forgetting where the coal comes from. So I spent time with my students down in Louisiana and also in West Virginia on the way down there. And if you were to take a look at what mountaintop removal does, or longwall mining in southwestern Pennsylvania, strip mining in central Pennsylvania, not here, but in western Pennsylvania, you'd realize that the term, as used by Obama and McCain, is a misleading one. That has to do with basically sequestration of the gases coming out of the coal plant. Sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxides aren't so difficult to deal with. Much more difficult to deal with is carbon dioxide. Both of them have strong faith in carbon sequestration, both biological sequestration and geological sequestration. Biological sequestration, when you grow trees to absorb the carbon dioxide, is only temporary because those trees eventually die and release the carbon dioxide back to the atmosphere. Geological sequestration right now is like the tooth fairy, as far as I'm concerned. It hasn't been proven yet. Maybe it's out there, maybe not, but it hasn't been proven yet on a commercial level, according to the USGS, U.S. Geological Survey. And even with geological sequestration of carbon dioxide, there is a known leak rate as you put the carbon dioxide underground under high pressure. And in the 2 minutes or minute I have left, I'll switch to my New York City mode of talk and speed it up a little bit. Let me just say that in terms of, why don't we just go to, we have drill baby drill, you heard about that, versus use it or lose it when it comes to offshore drilling. I'll mention that both candidates support, which is good, the right of California to set its own Clean Air Act standards because it was grandfathered in before the Clean Air Act was passed, California, and the rest of the state, California can set its own standards for automobile exhausts, I should say. And if that, many states have followed the California standard, that won't change much. Obama favors 40 miles per gallon standard for the fleet by 2020. McCain doesn't have a standard. He's okay with the existing standard for automobile mileage. And to finish off, I'll mention that one special interest group that I did rely on, other than the candidates' own websites for this information, was the League of Conservation Voters, who supported McCain in 2004 for a senatorial run, but gave him a zero score for 2007, the most recent year they have data for, because he missed all 15 or voted against all 15 major environmental initiatives before the Senate that year. Obama got a lifetime voting score of 67% versus McCain's lifetime voting score of 24%. Obama got a 100% voting record when he was a state Illinois senator. Now he's down to about 67%. That was in 2007. Based on his vote in those 15 major pieces of legislation. And I won't go into Palin. You know where she stands on the environment. But I want to point out that Biden has a 95%, one of the highest of any senator, a 95% lifetime rating from the League of Conservation Voters. Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from Professor Stephanie Gilmore. She's new in women's studies and is going to be talking to us about gender and women's issues, I think. Rachel. Or some slither of that that we can get for 7 minutes.
Thank you. As you know, a great deal of ink, of course, has been spilled over issues surrounding reproductive rights, especially abortion, and marriage, especially in the context of marriage equality in the space of about 8 minutes. I cannot possibly talk about all of the nuances of these topics. But these two issues are emblematic of what have become battlegrounds in the what have been labeled the culture wars, what was labeled the culture wars in the 1980s. In the media, they are deemed top of the ticket issues for voters, although I do not have reliable data that point to the reality that voters actually turn on these issues, or that votes actually turn on these issues. What I do know is that these issues are framed dichotomously, so that you must be either in favor of or in opposition to abortion or to marriage equality. There is very little room for ambivalence, and most people have already decided where they stand on these issues. So here I want to note where the two major candidates stand on these issues. This is also not a conversation where I'll be delving into other candidates, but I want to do this by way of discussing with you potential outcomes of a McCain administration and an Obama administration. I do not claim complete and full authority on these issues, and so I certainly hope and look forward to listening and learning from you as well. On marriage, Republican presidential candidate John McCain and his running mate Sarah Palin have clearly articulated a strong stand against marriage between two men or two women. Early on in the campaign, the McCain campaign released the following statement, quote, John McCain believes the institution of marriage is a union between one man and one woman. It is only this definition that sufficiently recognizes the vital and unique role played by mothers and fathers in the raising of children and the role of the family in shaping, stabilizing, and strengthening communities and our nation, end quote. He and Palin have been unambiguous in public speaking engagements, be it debates or afternoon talk shows. The vice presidential nominee broke with her running mate just over a week ago to state that she supported a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage, even though federal law under the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act already defines marriage exclusively as a union between one man and one woman. On the issue of marriage equality, senators and Democratic running mates Barack Obama and Joe Biden have both stated that neither supports extending the rights of marriage beyond one man and one woman. However, both have spoken openly about legal rights for same-sex couples. In the vice presidential debate, for example, Biden commented that he favored the rights of same-sex couples to visit each other in the hospital and to inherit money without additional penalties. These things matter, of course, but do not constitute the whole of marriage in our society or under the law. And there are many special rights bestowed to those who are allowed to marry that do not extend to the unmarried, either unmarried by choice or unmarried by law. Neither supports altering the Constitution, neither Barack Obama or nor Joe Biden support altering the Constitution to define marriage. Current federal legislation again does this. And agreeing with Senator McCain, they argue that states should have the right to define marriage. And this is where it gets very interesting, because although the rights of marriage are, many of the rights of marriage are bestowed at the federal level, the current battles for marriage equality and rights are taking place at the state levels. Massachusetts, California, and Connecticut have extended through court cases the right to marry to same-sex couples. Other states have acknowledged same-sex domestic partnership rights in an attempt to approximate rights of marriage at the state level. This year, Arizona, California, and Florida all have initiatives and propositions before state voters next week to determine at the state level whether marriage should be defined exclusively as one man or one woman. Floridians are voting on a marriage protection amendment that would remove any same-sex domestic partner benefits, while Californians are voting quite notably on Proposition 8. That's the one that's really sort of captured our attention, which, if passed, would eliminate the right of same-sex couples to marry, which currently does exist there. In Arizona, citizens are voting again to restrict marriage to one man and one woman. And so voters are certainly talking about marriage rights, and the immediate outcomes right now are at the state level, but this is not to say that there would not be federal implications or that the administration in the White House is not significant. As we saw in 2004, states with referenda on marriage equality have strong and complex campaigns tying the issues of marriage to presidential election outcomes. You know, presidents oversee federal and appointments of federal and Supreme Court justices that will undoubtedly hear these cases of marriage equality as they win their way through the judicial process. But we can certainly talk more about that. Another subject where there seems to be very little room to be ambivalent, at least in terms of the election and electoral political rhetoric, is abortion, which is most likely the most visible and debated platform within the larger realm of reproductive rights. Of course, the legalization of abortion at the federal level occurred in 1973 with the Supreme Court case Roe v. Wade, although four states have legalized abortion prior to Roe. Having and or providing abortion have not always been criminalized or criminal acts in U.S. history. Through a constitutional implied right to privacy, the court determined that women did in fact have a right to abortion and codified the trimester structure that we are familiar with. Senator McCain and Governor Palin have articulated a clear standpoint in opposition to abortion. Palin again separated from her running mate and the party's platform to state that she opposed abortion even in the case of rape or incest. McCain has maintained that, like the issue of marriage equality, the states should determine a woman's reproductive right to abortion. The campaign, according to its website, maintains, quote, "Once the question is returned to the state, the fight for life will be one of courage and compassion, the courage of a pregnant mother to bring her child into the world and the compassion of a civil society to meet her needs and those of the newborn baby." That's an end quote. It certainly does take the compassion of a civil society to meet the needs of each other. And the campaign has not been pressed on exactly how society will be able to meet the needs of women who choose to bear children. But on this subject of abortion, the Republican presidential candidate has been unswerving in his opposition to abortion and in favor of his desire to overturn Roe v. Wade. or to oversee it being overturned. Unlike political stances on the extension of marriage rights to same-sex couples, Senators Obama and Biden articulate an opposing viewpoint. The Democratic nominees state that they have been unequivocally in favor of reproductive choice. If elected, they have pledged that the administration, quote, will make preserving women's rights under Roe v. Wade a priority. Neither Obama nor Biden are pro-abortion. Indeed, Obama has joined many who claim the mantle of quote-unquote pro-choice to call for the need to reduce abortion through increased and comprehensive sex education, which includes the choice of abstinence as well as safer sex practices and more widely available contraception. Much like the issue of marriage equality, abortion and other aspects of reproductive rights are also at the center of state initiatives. The state of South Dakota, for example, has reintroduced a statewide ban on abortion. The proposed law before the people of South Dakota would offer little exception for abortion in the cases of rape, incest, or to account for the physical health of the mother. This would be the most direct challenge to Roe v. Wade. The initiative was first introduced in 2006 and made zero exceptions for rape, incest, or the health, physical health of the mother, and was done so on the heels of the appointment of Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court and with the explicit goal of overturning Roe v. Wade. So the connection here is, I think, rather explicit, more so than initiatives on marriage equality might be in terms of overturning the Defense of Marriage Act. But states across the country have also limited rights by legislation or ballot initiative, often resulting in limiting access to abortion through 24-hour laws, parental consent, mandating where abortions can take place and the like. In Oklahoma this year, next week in fact, people will vote on whether or not all pregnant women will have to undergo an ultrasound at 12 weeks at the 12-week point in pregnancy, whether or not she is going to have an abortion or whether or not she's considering an abortion with the intent of curbing it. In this election cycle, the state level seems to be, again, the site of more substantive, immediate changes to the right of abortion, but the ramifications certainly extend beyond individual states as well. Considering the abortion within the framework of the election also exposes, I think, the fallibility of the notion that Roe is untouchable. And I often hear people saying that. So when candidates expressly talk about overturning it altogether or keeping it intact, they talk about, you know, whether or not abortion will be constitutionally protected, which means that state by state, women will have different rights to access this. Also, they're talking about justices who will follow their wishes in this way. You know, abortion rights and personal feelings on Roe become a political litmus test. So again, we can see how the election matters, the presidential election matters, not only of who occupies the White House, but also his and conceivably her appointees to courts that continue to determine the constitutionality of state and federal laws. So I believe, you know, in conclusion, as thoughtful citizens, discussing these issues, elevating these issues is very important, especially because on this we tend to be, on these two topics among many others, we tend to be very polarized on one side or the other and live in a world certainly that reinforces these dichotomies. And so I'm elevating them, you know, by way of thinking about why it is that we elevate these issues and perhaps more to the point allow them to be elevated as top of the ticket issues. And of course our election season has brought them to the fore again for us to discuss. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, what we're going to do next is have student representatives who have been apparently polling their organizations for questions. Ask some questions for the panelists, and then we'll open it up to other questions. And I would like to say, by virtue of a coin toss, we're starting with, but I don't actually know either of you, so we'll start with you. I don't know if you're a Republican or the Democratic representative. Okay, so the Republican gets the first question by virtue of me going, okay.
This question's for
Introduce yourself, too, first.
Right. Hi, my name's Andrew Schumann. I'm a representative of the College Republicans, and my question is for Professor Kenny. You mentioned that a lot of American jobs have been going overseas. What role have high American corporate taxes and taxes on investment had in the flight of those, especially manufacturing jobs?
Right. I mean, it's a good question. And I think it's not simply the the role of the corporate tax structure, but the more important issue is high wages in the United States, right? We expect not simply in our manufacturing sectors, but in most sectors to have a wage that is sort of appreciating. And that is the primary driver of corporations leaving to go overseas. I mean, of course, we're going to have some type of calculation that's involved in terms of comparable tax rates. But for instance, our discussions about federalism have, I think, quite rightly pointed us in the direction of competition that states have actually been quite adept at creating a tax code that's going to attract businesses. For instance, Mercedes and BMW have set up shop in both South Carolina and Louisiana as a product of very competitive tax codes. So, you know, it's a global problem that advanced industrialized democracies are all facing. We're simply attempting to deal with it in a much more marketized form than, for instance, Europe does.
Thank you. And our Democratic representative, could you introduce yourself first?
Hi, my name is James Liskin. I'm the president of the College of Democrats. This is a question for Professor Gilmore. Mm-hmm. Last night, Delta Sigma Theta sorority held a program where they collected small slips of paper that students had dropped in boxes around the Student Union building about their thoughts on the election, who they were voting for, and why. And one of them stood out to me. They said, "I'm voting for John McCain because I'm a feminist and I want to see Sarah Palin in office." What link, if any, do you see between Sarah Palin and feminism?
That's a very good question. That is a good question because it's something that certainly has been a hot topic in the media, whether or not Sarah Palin is in fact a feminist. Sarah Palin first has never claimed that she is a feminist, so I believe in terms of self-identity, that is eminently relevant. But also the way that I define feminism, and I think the way many people would define feminism, is first a consciousness that men and women are inherently of equal worth, but that this society and many other societies do not, that our society privileges men as a group. And so I believe that level of consciousness, just being aware of differences in terms of equality between women and men, is relevant in terms of a feminist identity. A second element of that is acting on that, especially in terms of political equality. And Governor Palin has made many statements that demonstrate that she is not and has not advocated for equality, political equality, in a number of ways. And so I would not identify her as a feminist. Now, I think that certainly having women in positions of political visibility is very important, but I believe also, speaking for myself, that having feminists in political visibility is important too, and that's not an identity relegated just to women.
Okay, thank you. And back over to the Republican side, do you have another question? And introduce yourself.
Hello, everyone. My name is Matt Melchior. I'm a representative for the College Republicans, and my question is for Professor Sarkoen. What do you think of the Obama's plan to, you called it pay or play, and how that will affect employer-based healthcare and also will affect the cost of healthcare in the future for this country?
I think player pay is really an effort to create an all-inclusive system, that is to have everyone in as far as health insurance. I think if you look at other developed societies with regard to their insurance approach, there's a couple key themes that you see in all of them. One is with regard to access to care. One is with regard to coverage for everyone paid based on their ability. And the third and probably most important in that is that everyone's in and there's no exception. So I think it really kind of is a driver in some ways to create some incentive to eliminate, for lack of a better term, free riders. Now, of course, there's an opposite effect that could occur as a result of this. If the Obama plan really talks in terms of employer-based health insurance, the ability to sustain large groups of individuals, to spread risk, to bring down the administrative costs of insurance rather than pushing people into individual insurance, you could see that the potential due for firms to go to a player pay may make sense to them. That is that, in fact, that penalty may, in the long term, be somewhat less than trying to keep up with health insurance premiums over time. So although I think the initial attempt is to try to get everyone into the pool, there can be an opposite impact in the sense that you might see employer-based insurance dropped as firms looked at the cost of premiums, escalating premiums, or the cost of that penalty.
Go ahead. That's
your next. This is actually a question that one of our members sent in, which I think is important. In response to the economic crisis of the past few weeks, some economic observers have suggested that this crisis heralds the death of the Friedmanite Chicago school of free market economics thinking. With the Democratic landslide possible on November 4th, would this represent a national consensus around Keynesian economic principles? And this is for Professors Kenny and Sarkon.
Wow.
Or actually anyone who wants to.
So, right, I think it's a good question. It's probably a bit overblown. I mean, if we can read economic policy into the tax code, then the consensus that we've arrived at is that generally the American public prefers low taxes, but we want to continue to have relatively generous social spending, right? So we want, for the most part, to have our cake and eat it too. And Keynesian policy is likely to sort of have a renewed promise, I guess, and we're likely to see kind of a bad mouthing quite generally of markets run amok, and we have as a product of the bailout kind of heard a lot of this talk. Really strong levels of limited amounts of regulation is likely not to sort of be successful. What we're likely to see is a greater amount of regulation, particularly in the derivatives markets, right? And that's a complicated issue. We also sort of, I just wanted to make a second point, is that we've seen a tremendous rise in the discretionary authority, particularly of the Treasury Department, right? The next Treasury Secretary is going to have his hands full, not simply because he or she is going to be responsible for administering roughly $450 billion into the economy, but also because of this increased amount of regulatory capacity that the federal government has vested in the Treasury. So,
I want to add to that. I read the Financial Times. Environmental coverage is very good in that newspaper, as well as the New York Times. And I've heard the statement by both Republicans and Democrats that we're all Keynesian now. Now, I want to point out that the greatest expression of Keynesian economics in this country occurred, I think, in the early 1950s under Eisenhower, Republican president, as well as under Nixon. So it's not the reliance upon the state to intervene to protect capitalism from itself is not limited to just the Democratic administrations.
Okay. We can go one more cycle and then see what the crowd asks.
Okay. This question is actually for Professor Hyman. Economically speaking, one of the biggest problems with regards to pollution is the problem of public goods. For burning of fossil fuels, it benefits the two people who contract to sell it and then to use it in their cars, but it hurts society as a whole through pollution because the problem is that no one really owns the air. So there's been a number of proposals put forth that are kind of cap and trade. I wanted to focus on one of them that's called the Sky Trust System, which essentially would have every American citizen own an equal stake in the air, and there'd be a cap-and-trade system whereby companies buy credits for pollution, and then that money goes into the trust, which is channeled back to every individual citizen at an equal amount. And I was wondering if you think this will help to curb greenhouse gas emissions.
No. much more effective would be a carbon tax, a direct carbon tax. We have a cap-and-trade system, but supported by both the Democrat and Republican contenders for president. But there's some serious concerns that this is going to work. To have a successful cap-and-trade system, we have to actually measure very carefully not only the amount of carbon that you're putting into the atmosphere, but measures that you take to offset that carbon, whether it's planting a tree, which we don't know how long the tree's going to last, protecting the tree from, and so on, from decay, or from this, you know, buying up a forest in the Amazon somewhere and protecting it from the people who live there so that they don't cut it down out of frustration and burn it. A simple carbon tax on every upstream, on every pound of carbon taken out of the ground, whether it's gasoline, I mean petroleum or coal or natural gas, is much more effective and much more efficient, and is supported by most economists, that I've at least environmental economists, and is getting serious consideration now, at least in academic circles. However, it's political suicide right now to say the word tax. But as far as the actual implementation of a carbon tax, it can be impact neutral. By other words, by the money that's collected can be used to offset personal income tax or corporate tax as well. And I suspect that in time we will see both the European Union and the OECD and the U.S. moving away from cap and trade, which is extremely difficult to implement, towards a carbon tax. But both the candidates right now are not there yet, neither is the American public. But what you're referring to more is continuation of the attempt to come up with some kind of cap and trade system. Don't forget the American citizen, American taxpayer is not the only owner of the sky. We're talking about the global commons here. So how do we include the residents of Africa or Asia and so forth?
To whom I should direct this, but I guess Professor Kenny, this is yours.
A lot of the heavy lifting tonight.
All right, so some political observers have mentioned, and at least, I mean, I've kind of heard this as well, that the Senate is being, or I guess there's a reduction of civility and consensus in the Senate. And on November 4th, there's a distinct possibility that the U.S. Senate will have a Democratic majority, a filibuster-proof majority, that's 60 seats. What effect do you think that will have, or what effect do you think a filibuster-proof Democratic majority will have on that body?
It's a great question, and it's a sort of moment in political history that we haven't seen since Lyndon Johnson. It's difficult to say, and so much of the sort of times, and maybe this is now becoming cliche, but so much of the times that we live in is we're essentially in uncharted waters. I would imagine that, of course, you're likely, if you work with congressional modeling, you're likely to push toward a more left-leaning type of policy outcome. So we would expect a filibuster-proof Senate, along with a Democratic president, to produce policy that's going to be more in keeping with our understanding of a broadly interventionist style of governing. And exactly what that's likely to, or what that's going to look like, is difficult to say. I would say, of course, the points about a more attention to increasing amounts of income inequality in the United States, rising attention to problems of healthcare. I would say the discussions about nationalizing healthcare would probably be much more viable than they might be if you do have a filibustering Senate, and probably third, a kind of broader focus on environmental regulation. I would say that there is more likelihood that we would see a robust regulatory structure put in place to kind of reinvigorate the Clean Air Act.
I don't actually think it's, I think those are all good points. I don't think it's a given. Having party discipline, to align Democrats, it may be more of a wish than a fact. If you take a look at typical senatorial offices, they're essentially businesses. They're businesses to get reelected. And so they're going to be, I think, somewhat more responsive to their to who they represent oftentimes. And if you throw into that, this is kind of looking at, this visibility, I'm kind of getting out to an area that I'm really not sure, but this issue of kind of earmarking and trying to create, favor, and trying to align a vote, if that becomes more visible, it might become more difficult also, I think, to pull people into line. So I wouldn't jump on the bandwagon and say that's inevitable, but you can get pretty close. You could still get majorities in many cases and move things forward.
And to the extent that the question is about civility, a media person has to say we have a different media system than back in Lyndon Johnson's day, that is going to continue to encourage incivility in terms of attention grabbing and this sort of thing. And it would be who's civil to whom. And so being a more frustrated minority party can mean a more rhetorically aggressive one, and might actually make the impression, at least, that we have of what's going on in the Senate even more divisive. So, all right, now let's open up the questions to the crowd over here.
This is for Professor Sarcone. I know a lot of the focus in terms of healthcare has been on the uninsured. And you know, my family, I feel like, from my understanding, we have great insurance. How will either of the candidates affect people who are privately insured and who are happy with the insurance they have?
I think they've been both very, very careful about trying to build off the existing system, that is, for better or for worse. And so that in both cases, in the McCain literature in particular, with regard to the tax-exempt shield going away and with regard to the refundable tax credit, in the literature it says, you know, keep your, you know, if you have employer-based insurance or if you have insurance that you like, there's no need to move away from it. In fact, you know, it's really the refund is to make that more more affordable, and clearly in a democratic process, they're really talking in terms of maintaining employer-based insurance. Now, the interesting part of that gets back to an earlier comment. There's been some criticism in the literature with regard to the Republican position that particularly the removal of the tax shield and the provision of the refundable tax credits may move firms away from providing insurance and basically, you know, pushing people out into kind of the individual insurance market. Now, that could become problematic in the sense that if the insurance you currently, you know, if you have to switch insurances or things of that nature without any guarantees of eligibility, issues of condition, you know, preconditions, and that may create some, you know, some problematic issues with continuing insurance. And I'm not saying that I could see where that could possibly happen in that particular situation, but both at this point strongly support continued employer-based insurance. It's easy for them to say that. It's another question about, given the change in the regulatory framework and in the competitive environment, whether firms will make that decision to continue employer-based coverage or not. I think probably a little bit more likely that they may move away from it in the Republican model in contrast to the Democratic model.
Can I add something to that? Just some figures. The World Health Organization came out with some figures for 2007. The most widely regarded measure of human health is, one of the most widely regarded measures is infant mortality rate. The United States came in 29th out of the leading industrial nations in the world in infant mortality rate. We're behind Cuba. This is not I never saw the movie Sicko. This is from the World Health Organization itself. We're 29. We're on the same level as Slovakia. We're behind Greece. We spend about $2,400 per capita on health care in this country. That's almost twice as much as the next nation. $25,000 on average for a family of four. Even with private health care, we're probably paying a lot more than we need to. Good, and we can probably get good health care for a lot less than the system that's delivering it to us now. It's my personal opinion.
Other questions?
Is it working? Okay. I'm thinking the Supreme Court is obviously a little bit leaning towards the Republican ideals. And with this next administration, how many Supreme Court justices do you feel would be coming up for appointment, and what do you think the effect would have of each party choosing those numbers and weighing that court in one direction or another? And that's to you, Professor Gilmore.
That's a good question. It's speculated that as many as two is what I've heard, that two, and you can correct me if that's wrong. Candidate or two justices would be up to be replaced, and so I think in terms of Ginsburg and Stevens, yes, and so yes, yeah, so both of them in that direction, and so I think in terms of the Supreme Court, the balance under an Obama administration, that the court would stay roughly the same in terms of its construction. Under a McCain administration, I do believe, and he has made very clear, both McCain and Palin have made very clear that the desire to support more conservative justices, Supreme Court justices, so I believe the court would certainly tilt more to the right.
I want to add that we have one of the nation's most esteemed observers of the Supreme Court sitting with us here. He probably doesn't want me to call on him, but if Harry wants to say a few words about to that question, that would be most welcome.
That would be fantastic.
Well, I think Stephanie's is correct that,
I think Stephanie is generally correct that two, possibly three, I believe the who you vote for a president will have a significant impact on the character of those appointments as to their philosophy. I think it's fair to say that a McCain as president will continue Republican tradition of appointing judges that are perceived to be non-policy-making, strict interpreters of the Constitution, which may be labels or covers regarding the issues that Stephanie discussed. So I think I agree with Stephanie that this issue of the court is one in which there are clear differences. Mm-hmm. And I also agree that talk about this area is very speculative. I never predict Supreme Court decisions. I used to. I gave it up.
I guess I'd also want to remark, in terms of that handout I sent around, the second website that I say is another option for issue positions is a little more confusing to navigate, but they have a whole section on the history of issues, and in that are a lot of terms. So, like, if you're hearing litmus test and, you know, strict construction, and you're like, I'm not quite sure what the implication of that means in this issue area. They sort of break that down for you pretty well. And it can be confusing because the politicians are not always using the language consistently. And sometimes they're kind of hiding behind some of that and trying to appeal to multiple audiences. So in that third debate, when you hear McCain saying, and as an answer to the abortion question, I would not use a litmus test to appoint someone about that, but then pushed by the moderator, oh, so you're open to appointing a pro Roe v. Wade justice? He was like, well, no, that wouldn't be a qualified person. So it's like, qualifications, where is all of this? I mean, I think that we can probably, you know, just make the assumption that a Republican president is going to make different appointments than a Democratic president. And some might be more aggressive in it and some might not, but that this is a real part of the consideration you want to hold, regardless of how they might sort of dance around the idea of qualified and you know, I'm going to be reluctant to do this or that. It's part of, you know, the perk of office, I suppose. It's part of the responsibility to make that appointment. And so you can sort of go past the strategy talk on that and just say, who would I rather make the selection?
Thank you. Is this on?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, you're good.
My name is Josh Handelsman. I'm a first year. This is for Professor Sarcone. One thing that you mentioned was the idea of the guaranteed access plan that McCain has proposed to give people with pre-existing conditions a chance at affordable health insurance.
Right.
I'm kind of confused because I haven't heard. Has he said what he would cap the premiums at, like what the premium would be under that plan, and also where the money would come from to fund the guaranteed access plan?
That seems to be a luxury of most politicians to essentially kind of state a policy position or kind of a direction, but not really talk in terms of the operational detail or the costs associated with that. And I had an opportunity, I mean, I, as we all did, really look closely at the literature from both campaigns, and essentially what the plan, the Republican plan, says is we're really going to, you know, have a light hand with regard to insurance firms. That is, you know, let the market play out, which would then indicate that those insurance firms would still have, you know, a significant ability to choose who they selected to be in their pool. Clearly, the less risk, the greater opportunity for profitability rather than payout. So what would happen is those individuals who would not be able to obtain insurance as a result of their current health status would have an opportunity to purchase insurance through what's referred to as a gap, as you mentioned. And these would be state-run entities supported by the state. In fact, they exist. They're out there right now. If you tried to get into the gap in California, you got about an 8-year wait. But that's a whole other story with regard to whether they work or not. And indicated in the literature that the cost of these plans would be made affordable, whatever that means. I hope that helps with the structure. No, they don't really talk in terms of what the premium costs would be to the individuals or what the package of benefits associated with those would be or what the delineation would be with who would be eligible and who would not be eligible. I'm going to talk just for a second about this because it's a concern of I think that people should think about. You know, in the effect that you were unable to get insurance and yet, you know, may fall in that gray area between, you know, obtaining a policy kind of from the provider of last resort, I think that just creates a lot of tension and anxiety for individuals. And I have some real concern about, you know, really the handoff there and kind of operationalizing that concept. In contrast, the Democratic approach says, look, everybody's in, community rating, no preconditions, the insurance company, the purpose of insurance is to spread risk, and in the event that a particular insurance firm has significant losses as a result of in that being open to enrolling people, takes some significant losses as a result of catastrophic cases, the reinsurer becomes the federal government who goes in to help subsidize or offset those losses. And so that kind of uncertainty or anxiety associated with being able to access health insurance, I think, is a little bit less. Now, again, this is based on a reading of both plans, which are very broad and, you know, very open. So I'm sure these issues have been thought through from the Republican standpoint, but that was my first read.
Okay. Another question.
Thanks. This question is for Professor Gilmore. Mm-hmm. Last night I went to a presidential faith forum. Church is about 30 minutes away. And by both evangelical directors for the Obama and McCain campaigns were there, Sean Casey and Miles Pompas, respectively. By far and away, abortion was the number one issue. But the thing that really confused me was the fact that, you know, Ms. Pompa spoke about McCain's stance on being pro-life, and then Donald Miller, Representative Obama campaign, spoke up and said, we basically agree with you, and spoke of how all that both candidates agree that the Roe v. Wade to be repealed, but pretty much not realistic, considering even considering George Bush, since when he went to office in 2001, couldn't accomplish it, even though he put in very conservative justices. Justice Roberts, a very conservative judge, isn't even for repealing Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. Given all this, does their view on abortion really matter, considering they can't do anything?
I think that's a very compelling question because it speaks to precisely, you know, the elevation of the issue of abortion, for example, to this top of the ticket issue. But I think because it's becoming media driven, and Stephanie Larson can probably speak even more about the sort of media drive behind this particular issue, among a couple of other sort of hot button emotion-driven issues. I do believe that Obama and McCain have different positions on abortion. Obama has been very forthright to talk about maintaining the right of women to have access to abortion. He's also spoken very clearly about reducing need for abortion through comprehensive, making more comprehensive sex education available, talking about abstinence, but also safer sex practices. He has come out in opposition to the Hyde Amendments, which were passed in 1976, curbing federal monies available for abortion, which directly affected people on Medicaid, women on Medicaid, the health, National Health Insurance Policy for low-income women or low-income people, but also people in the military, women in the Peace Corps, women who are affected by Indian services, things, people like that. So any federal funds. He has come out in opposition to the Hyde Amendments and has spoken about repealing them, whereas Senator McCain has spoken very much about his opposition to abortion without talking so much about comprehensive sex education. And so I do believe their policies, their positions differ. Neither one of them, of course, is pro-abortion and both very much talking about wanting to reduce the need for abortion, absolutely. Both are also promoting adoption. And talking about other opportunities available. So, I do believe that there are differences in the campaigns.
Okay, I have maybe one last question so we can all get out of here. I keep looking at the same person, so let's call on him.
This is a question for Professors Sarcone and Kenny. I have heard about both candidates' plans to help balance the budget and save the economy. You know, Obama wants to use a scalpel, McCain a chainsaw, but obviously neither of them could do it alone. They're going to be working with, you know, well-trained economists. So I guess my question is, what are the benefits, cons, pros and cons of each strategy, and who are the other people who will be involved in either candidate's plan?
Well, Obama tapped a guy named Jason Furman, who's a Harvard-trained economist, who was previously, before he was the economics director for the Obama campaign, worked as the sort of lead spokesman for a group that worked out of the Brookings Institution called the Hamilton Project. And the focus of that group was to figure out a variety of ways that were going to be sort of extend what became much popular, sort of the popularized Clintonite economics, sort of third way. And it's a this group, Furman, is kind of a descendant of that group. And Rubin is also on their, or was on their board for a while. Neither candidate is going to be able to balance the budget at least in the first term. I mean, that seems to be a total fiction. And I don't think actually either candidate, recently at least, has promoted the idea of any kind of a balanced budget. They're both going to be digging out of this budget surplus for, of the bailout for a number of years, and figuring out exactly how that is done is going to, of course, be a challenge.
I would agree. I think, you know, when over the years, when you take a look at just health care reform, as with major social reform, there's always a couple of issues which kind of popularly jump up as reasons why it hasn't occurred. Political will is one, multiple solutions to problems, and the inability to select a solution. But the big ones, what a surprise, is the, you know, initial investment, the cost associated with making large systemic changes. And given the constraints, I think, in the federal budget, and again, with regard to entitlement payments, really kind of limiting what discretion there is, I would, and it's my sense, at least in healthcare, that there'll be some modest efforts, but nowhere near what these plans call for. In fact, what I would suggest is that some of the programs, if you take a look at, say, for example, medical assistance, which is a state and federal split, depending on, and it varies a percentage depending on the wealth of the individual states, and the Medicare program in particular, which at this point, I mean, without being too dramatic, they're talking about being, you know, in a state of bankruptcy within the next 4 or 5 years. What I think you're going to actually see are probably some very strong cutbacks. I mean, in cutbacks by staying flat or actually declining reimbursement, either in scope of services provided or level of reimbursement provided per service.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the panel for giving us all this information, and you for coming.
The Clark Forum would like to especially thank the Political Science Department for sponsoring and for taking the lead in organizing tonight's event. This concludes tonight's program. Thank you for attending.